Adult Election 2025 is a national election series airing on campus and community radio stations across Canada, bringing you diverse voices, in-depth conversations, and perspectives that are often unheard. The initiative is supported by the Covering Canada Elections 2025 Fund. Tune in live on April 28th for our election night coverage and visit altelxn.ca for more information.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain.
Canada Land, funded by you.
I'm Jesse Brown, and today we're bringing you the story of a guy named Larry, who has been protecting Canada's Arctic sovereignty for the past 72 years.
I'm just watching the great powers in between me and down there and over there, and it's almost like a bad nightmare.
Wait for that.
Greatest defense is about to become your softest underbelly. China and Russia, the great powers, and the United States fighting it out over the Arctic is going to be the new great game of the 21st century. Canada, you are thrust into the middle of that, and quite frankly, you're the great prize of that. When you guys think through the hard decisions that have to be made, particularly the Arctic, particularly hemispheric defense, particularly geoeconomically, what this means, internal logic is going to drive you that somehow we have to figure out how to partner with the United States. That's what President Trump's genius is.
There's something uniquely terrifying about the realization that the ideas of people like Steve Bannon shape global events. But they do. He and other men who use the term geopolitical more than they ought to have been banging on about the Arctic for some time now. Some of these dudes have podcasts. Some of them have the ears of world leaders. And some of them have both. And now, the notion that Canada must drop everything to race up north to protect the Arctic is suddenly everywhere, including in Pierre Poilievre's platform. And just 4 days after Mark Carney became prime minister, he flew up to Nunavut to announce a $6 billion radar defense program. At a minimum, these new adventures are going to change some people's lives. People living in Canada's north will find themselves at the center of major world events. Again. Turns out, this is not the first time that our political discourse got overheated with anxieties about some hypothetical snowy battle on a glacier to come, some fantasy of an imminent icy World War III. And the last time it happened, who paid the price? Who was sent to claim our northern border? To let the commies know we didn't just own some Arctic, we were also using it. Who? Larry. His name is Larry. And of the people who were sent up there with Larry, well, he's the last of them who is still up there. And our senior producer, Bruce Thorson, got Larry on the phone just the other week. Wait for it.
Larry tells the story. It starts like this.
Beautiful September morning. Calm, yet calm. I guess you would call it the Inuit version of Indian summer, I guess, in September in the beginning. Beautiful, warm day.
Two men were walking along the shore when they first saw it. It was maybe a kilometer offshore. A small boat It couldn't have been longer than about 20 feet. Not the kind of boat you'd expect to see bobbing up and down in the open ocean. And the guy in the boat, well, they definitely weren't expecting him. He was a stranger. Obviously, in a town with a population of just under 150, everybody knows everybody. Or as Larry puts it,
people know who's who. There are days when you don't care to know about your neighbor's dirty laundry. That's the life in a small community. It's like you're living in a little fishbowl. But this man thought otherwise. He thought nobody would know him, that he could get away with it. And he almost did.
As Larry says, he almost got away with it. But maybe that's because the stranger was trying to get away with, was, to put it bluntly, nuts. Larry and his neighbors don't get many surprise visitors. After all, there's no roads connecting them to any other towns. The nearest other town is about 360 kilometers away. As for airports, the town's sole airstrip is only about 500 meters long. It's mostly good for twin otters, small, tough planes like that. The runway isn't even paved. It's just a strip of gravel surrounded by mountains. You need special training just to attempt a landing. So yeah, not a lot of tourists. This little boat bobbing up and down in the ocean was definitely something new. Eventually, the Mounties would start to piece it together. Turns out this solo sailor had braved 1,500 kilometers of open ocean to reach Larry's town. He'd sailed from a small village down south, in Greenland. Let's face it, there's not a lot of people in the world who can say things like, you know, that town, down south, in Greenland. The name of the town where the sailor set out from is Holsteinborg. But this guy, he's no Holsteinborger. Soon, the cops would learn he was in fact Romanian.
Well, I think he was nuts in the first place. Here's a man who's not thinking like you and I would normally.
It's a crazy story. It's a crazy story. Like, what did you think? I mean, it was a small boat, and he came up from Greenland. He traveled over 1,000 kilometers. I'm guessing there were icebergs along the way. I don't know how long that trip would have taken. It's kind of a miracle to me that he ever got there, but it seems completely nuts.
What did you think about his seamanship, or was it just a miracle he survived? It seems like a very treacherous journey. Like, what did people think when they saw this little boat?
Yeah, well, the passage that he took, that area is very treacherous. He almost drowned if he had capsized. His windshield got hit by ice, water after water, and the windshield came off. He almost didn't make it.
They didn't know much about this guy, but they did get one clue to his success in navigating the treacherous Arctic waters. When the sailor finally stepped ashore, a horseshoe fell out of his because it turns out that by the time he got to town, he only had about a gallon of fuel left. That's just enough to take him somewhere around 5 more nautical miles. He'd made it. But no one was expecting him to stay in town. So the locals asked where he was headed. And the sailor said he was going to Toronto. Oh, Toronto. Just another town down south. 3,600 kilometers down south. And the sailor did have a name. Florin Fodor. The locals, despite being surprised to see him wash up on their shore, well, They'd been waiting for Florin Fodor for 54 years. There's a picture of Fodor from that time. This was back in 2006 when he landed. It's pixelated, blurry, but you can see a stocky man. He's about 32 years old, wearing a gray sweater, camel pants that belong on a hunter, a baseball hat, and he's standing on his little boat. And seriously, it looks like the kind of mucking about fishing boat you'd find on a prairie lake. It doesn't even look like there's room for him to lay down in the thing. Larry's hometown, the place where Florin Fodor landed, is called Grise Fjord. It's on the southern tip of Ellesmere Island, and it's the northernmost town in Canada. Larry's lived there nearly all of his 75 years.
My name is Larry Outlaluk. I'm from Grise Fjord, and I'm a hunter, former hunter guide. By trade, I'm a truck driver and gas station attendant, that kind of work.
Larry is also humble. Apart from being a polar bear hunter and a trucker, Larry's an author. His book is called What I Remember, What I Know, The Life of a High Arctic Exile. It was shortlisted for the Governor General's Award for nonfiction. Here's some old tape of a younger Larry laying out the start of his own story.
I remember the cold mornings when we were living in the tent the first year.
This audio comes from a 30-year-old NFB documentary called Broken Promises.
Our first year or two, it was. I remember the mornings being very cold and the walls being very dark. And years later, I found out those were old buffalo hides, which were used for insulation in our tent.
In 1953, Larry was just 3 years old, and he was living in a tent in Grise Fjord because there was no town there. At that point, it was just a handful of tents for seven Inuit families, totaling 87 people. Larry is Inuit, but his family didn't belong in Grise Fjord. None of the 87 people stranded on the shore belonged there. They'd been transplanted to this barren shore by the RCMP.
There was nothing up here, and we didn't have any infrastructure, and in fact, my family was not to get any kind of shelter, and it was very difficult time for us.
Grise Fjord was an alien land for Larry's family. Their ancestral home was nearly 2,000 kilometers south in Quebec. So why was Larry's family dropped on the frozen shores of Ellesmere Island? The answer? Sovereignty. In the 1950s, Russia and the Americans were staring each other down, aiming Cold War nuclear weapons across the Arctic.
The Arctic. Desolate. Savage. Remote. A wilderness of unending barren vistas.
This is a clip from a 1950s newsreel.
Through most of the year, locked in bitter cold and almost endless darkness. In the short summers, a swamp-like morass. Not too bad for caribou or polar bears, but no place for human beings. Yet this roof of the world holds a stark menace to our country, to our very existence.
Laying out the Cold War battleground and its focus on the North.
The menace lies in the basic new fact of our time that no two nations on Earth are any longer cut off from each other by geography. What was once the impassable Arctic now provides the quickest routes for attack from a wide sector of Europe and Asia. Beset by the nightmare of this threat.
The Canadian government worried about the Russians, but also the Americans, who were eyeing northern military bases. Canada was wondering about its claim to really be a nation stretching from coast to coast to coast. So a plan was born in Ottawa. Transplant a group of Inuit from northern Quebec north to Ellesmere Island. inhabit the island, and cement our northern claims. So how did the government get 87 people from northern Quebec to leave their homes, their families, their way of life, and move 2,000 kilometers north to the high Arctic, sight unseen? Well, they made some promises.
When we were being moved, I have written documentation about the relocation, that we were to be looked after, that we did not have to worry about anything. We just come and pack up our sleeping bags and tents and hunting equipment, our dog teams, and get on the ship, and we will go to a place where we can live well. We will be looked after.
And of course, the plan worked perfectly, and they all lived happily ever after. No. You're not buying that?
Unfortunately, it didn't happen the way it was described. Sadly, that did not happen. And my father figured out what was going on when he realized that the government had no intention of honoring their promises. That's where that word broken promises was used one time in the documentary.
The Broken Promises documentary highlights RCMP documents talking about Larry's father and his fate. Larry's father's nickname was Fatty.
Fatty was our leader. He was our father. The people that took us there misled us about what we should have found. So he used to say, They promised, we were going back. They promised that we were going to have a steady diet of caribou. His spirit started to slow down when he realized that it was not going to be as they had promised. His spirits fell fast, and he didn't make it throughout the first year.
RCMP report, Craig Harbor, 1954. One death occurred, Fatty. E9713, due to heart attack.
So we lived up here, and mother cries for help were ignored. They were not even heard. Many of the people wanted to go back home. And so we felt betrayed, of course.
So, recap. In 1953... the feds are fretting over Russian and American moves on the Arctic. Sound familiar? They moved a group of Inuit families 2,000 kilometers north to plant the flag on Ellesmere Island. In a sadly predictable chain of events, promises were not kept. No housing, no reliable food sources. Oh, and by the way, the sun will disappear for 3 months. According to Larry, the people moved north weren't told that small detail. Watching the days disappear until there's nothing but night for 3 months? Nothing but the dark season.
The dark season had a very deadly, in a way, consequences that my parents talked about. And the dark season was such bad influence on everyone.
The move was a tangle of lies and harebrained schemes fueled by political paranoia. But over the decades, the people of Greasefjord did build up a town. Today, the population of just under 150 has much of what you'd expect in a northern community. Homes, a school, an RCMP detachment, a small landing strip, a clinic, but no doctor. Greasefjord became what Ottawa in the 1950s wanted it to be. Canada's northernmost town, a bulwark against the northern ambitions of other countries. And those 1950s worries might sound a bit familiar.
At a time when Canadians have become increasingly concerned about sovereignty, Canada's new Prime Minister went north of 60 to shore up Arctic security.
We cannot and should not look first to others to defend our nation. The Arctic is important for both Russia and the world, and competition over the region is intensifying.
And I also have a message tonight for the incredible people of Greenland. We need Greenland for national security and even international security, and we're working with everybody involved to try and get it. One way or the other, we're going to get it.
Yeah, this is the point in the story. Election. Because today, despite the fact that it feels...
Welcome to CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. Just interrupting Canada Land to bring you now to our participation in the NCRA's alternative election broadcast coverage, featuring participation from stations across the country. We'll be going from now until 11 p.m. or until... the results are completely in and complete and dusted. So this is hosted out of a couple different stations across the country. The West Coast Hub is in Sydney, just south of Victoria. And later on in the evening, myself and Danny will be joining the broadcast as West Coast correspondents. So without further ado, we're going to head right there to the stream. Right now we have Kinza Zafar, the East Coast producer of tonight's broadcast.
Rather alarming to kind of have in your past, especially with how big the names are in this scandal that, you know, he allegedly did. So it's quite, you know, it's alarming, it's interesting, and it's going to be quite the turnout about how it comes out. If, you know, if he does take it, will this, you know, come on to further haunt him while he's in office, or will this kind of thing go on to subside later on? And as, you know, he goes on to do whatever he does, if he does win.
Mm-hmm. And it is interesting because it's like, if you are someone who is consistently voting Liberal, you kind of have now two changes. There's no more Trudeau, and now it's Carney. And then now in the Toronto Centre, it's no longer Mercien. And now we have Evan Sullivan. So I think that it'll be very interesting for those people who want to keep Toronto a Liberal stronghold, kind of dealing with these changes and what that kind of reflects.
Yeah, no, for sure. Especially because, you know, I'm sure now more than ever, as, you know, time has gone on in Canada and the world has kind of become very politically divided. So it's rather interesting to find that Toronto is still very much a strong Liberal hold in, you know, in the country, you know. And, you know, historically, rather, you know, when it comes to premiership and prime ministership, you're usually opposites. So, you know, a liberal premiers usually ends up having a conservative in office as prime minister, and, you know, and vice versa. So with that, I mean, it's going to be interesting. With no matter who wins, it's going to be a pretty tight race. Does that worry you at all, or do you have any concerns about that?
About it being a tight race?
Yes.
Yeah, I think it's going to be really interesting. I mean, we've seen the polls. You know, the projected polls kind of flip-flop, especially, obviously, since Trump came into office, since the tariffs came into place. And it's really interesting because it's kind of sidelining some of the issues that would normally be at play in a regular election. But now we have all these unprecedented issues like the tariffs, like the fact that this is even a snap election and it's not in the normal election schedule. It's just going to be really interesting. It is a little... worrying, because what happens to these other issues that are normally at the forefront when they're kind of overshadowed by things like the tariffs and also the threats of annexation as via U.S. President Donald Trump, things like that.
Yeah, and I'm sure we've all, you know, have heard all about, you know, the 51st state that we are and the potential future where that might hold. And, you know, there is always, I think, a worry about that now. As you mentioned, we live in unprecedented times, and I think the reality of it is that we've always kind of lived in unprecedented times, and that only gets truer and truer every year. You know, I don't think anybody would have, you know, expected Trudeau to step down quite the way he did and how early he did. And so I think most people would say that it is Carney's only thing he could do was to call the snap election. So, I mean, it's such a short amount of time for these politicians to kind of get their platforms ready and going. So, I mean, even just how short notice it all is going to be, you know, incredibly interesting, especially with how it turns out, because this is the next 4 years of our lives.
Mm-hmm. And we've also seen this kind of snap election during an unprecedented time in the provincial election in Ontario. We saw that Doug Ford took a sweeping win, and most of his platform was strictly on, you know, on the tariffs, on Donald Trump's threats. Do you think that this has a possibility of mirroring these outcomes in the federal election?
I think when it comes to the federal election, especially Canadians, you know, I think the hardest part about getting, you know, anybody interested, and this has been the hardest part about for Canadians in Canadian history, is how do you get Canadians to care about Canada? And I think this is, you know, has done something that I think has never really happened, which is instilled and inspired a lot of patriotism and on both sides, Liberal, Conservative, NDP, everywhere you see now, everyone's very pro Canada, and that's the stance that everybody is taking here in this election. Now it's all about the solidarity between Canadians, and so it's going to be it's a confusing time, I would say, that not only is there this, you know, rising patriotism for Canada and everything that we do, you know, Canadian industry, Canadian media, Canadian everything, but I don't think it's going to play out in the way that any of us really truly expect in the polls or whatnot. I think it's going to be quite the surprise for anybody.
It is really interesting, and it's strange because this kind of pro or like Canadian patriotism historically has kind of been more of a quiet patriotism. It's been, you know, very proudly to be Canadian, but more in the like wear a Canadian flag lapel on your backpack when you travel, stuff like that. But now it's a little bit more like vocally Canadian. So it's really interesting to see how all the different parties are kind of almost capitalizing off of this idea and using it in their platforms, because it, you know, historically has signified kind of different meanings, this type of patriotism.
Yeah, especially because of how big Canada is as a country, that, you know, the west coast of Canada thinks differently from the Atlantic, from the central to the east coast, everywhere in Canada thinks differently. But it, now wherever you go, you can find exactly which products are Canadian in any store. You know, everybody's always talking now about the big game of hockey that we played and beat the Americans, and how, you know, Canadians responded to, you know, that with, you know, the 51st state, you know, when we win the game, now all of a sudden America is the 11th province in some people's eyes. So, you know, this level of patriotism is, you know, it's crazy. It's not something that, you know, you see every day, especially in Canada. As you mentioned, it's a very quiet patriotism. And as we've seen with other prime ministers, you know, with, you know, Stephen Harper, when he tried to kind of emulate some of America's patriotism with kind of infamously at one of his speeches saying, you know, ending it with "God bless Canada," everyone was just like, "Whoa, what is this? That's weird." You know, it's not like it's a very quiet patriotism, unless, you know, we win a big sports game or something, like we saw in 2010 with the Vancouver Olympics winning gold.
Mm-hmm. On the topic of sports, it's really interesting because, you know, we saw like Canadians booing the national anthem in those heightened times, and it's just going to turn out to be a really, really interesting one. You know, we did talk about the Toronto Centre riding, the Liberal riding. Could you talk a little bit about the Conservative riding?
Of course. So in Toronto Centre, it's Louis Ibarra. Sorry if I butchered that. It's quite early, but we got a lot of names to get through. But he is he studied communications in Mexico. He's here in Toronto Centre. He's bilingual, English and Spanish. He is a proud member of the LGBTQ2+ community. So, you know, he's, you know, believes in fairness, equality for all. He's quite a strong advocate on mental health and fair wages and tax reductions for Canadians, which is, you know, the tax reductions at least are a very standard conservative package for conservative candidates. So he is he's quite a different type of, you know, when you think of conservative, he's quite a different aspect of it. And that's kind of all the time we have now. So thank you, Amber, for your time.